This year, this program, Focus, turned 30, and we have been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that feature some of our most interesting guests and touch on a broad range of topics, everything from politics to popular culture. Over the years, we've been fortunate enough to have a number of musicians on the show, and in this installment of what we're calling the Deep Archives Project, you will hear two of them, Billy Taylor and William Warfield. Billy Taylor was known around the world as a pianist, an educator, and tireless advocate for jazz. He played with many of the giants of jazz, including Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis. He appeared often on radio and television to perform and also to talk about music, and he spent a lot of time working with students of all ages. He was the recipient of many honors and awards, including Downbeat Magazine's Lifetime Achievement Award, the National Medal of the Arts, and more than 23 honorary doctoral degrees. He was a guest on our show. Back then we called it Focus 580, and in January of 1990. In his book, Jazz Piano, A Jazz History, he writes that jazz is America's classical music. So I asked him to talk about that.
One of the obvious things is the fact that jazz is a way of playing, and it's a repertory of pieces that has defined that way of playing as it has developed over the years. It uses spontaneous composition, which we normally refer to as improvisation, as a means to do this. That spontaneity, that freedom of individual expression, is one of the most attractive features that jazz has had for people outside of the United States, people who don't enjoy the opportunity to express themselves as freely as we take for granted. I mean, we can just say whatever we want to say about the President of the United States or about Congress or about any of the authority figures and not be reprimanded. I mean, we don't get put in jail or beat up or anything like that. So, but in many places, that's not the case. And so they envy the fact that one can play, can take a theme and use the jazz style to express this kind of freedom. In Czechoslovakia and in Poland, people were put in jail for doing just what I'm talking about. And a little earlier, before the recent relaxation of attitudes in Russia, that was the case there. And so one of the things that jazz expresses is individual freedom. It also expresses the rhythm of we're an energetic nation. And we have a lot of a kind of personal esprit, if you will. And that's reflected in the music. I mean, if you're talking about the jazz masters of the past, like John Coltrane or Charlie Parker or Duke Ellington, it's there, Louis Armstrong, whoever. If you're talking about the jazz masters of the present, Art Blakey or any of the younger musicians like Wynton Marsalis and some of the other musicians, it's there.
Also, in the preface to the book, Jazz Piano, you talk about how very early in your life you were really attracted to jazz and wanted to learn everything you could about it and how you could express yourself through it. And I wonder what about that music attracted you?
It's hard to say. I just came from Washington, D.C., where I grew up, and we spent the last week there. And I was talking to a cousin of mine and some other family members, and we were reminiscing about the old days when the family used to come over to my basement and we would play the piano and records and all kinds of stuff. And I got to thinking about the uncle who really was personally responsible for my beginning interest in jazz. And I guess the thing that attracted me to it was that he was having so much fun. I mean, he sat at the piano. Everybody in my family played the piano and sang. My father played, his sisters and brothers sang. And everybody was very serious. I mean, they all sat there and they played Mozart and they played Bach. And this was serious stuff. I mean, it sounded good, but it was serious, you know. Mm-hmm. Uncle Bob sat there and he just kind of hung out, man. I mean, it was swinging along. And he was grinning and smoking a cigarette. And it was just, it was fun, you know. Yeah, I wouldn't play like that. And I never got around to smoking a cigarette, but it was fun to play the piano.
And so that's what attracted you to that instrument? That's why you're a pianist?
Basically, because that was there was a piano in the home, and that was available. I played, the gentleman was asking you earlier if I ever played any other instruments. Yes, I played saxophone and guitar and drums, and I fooled around, as most young people do, with several instruments before I settled back on the piano, because... like most people, I wanted to play immediately, and I kept thinking that one of these other instruments might be easier than the piano. It wasn't, so I came back to the piano.
I think I also read, too, that you talked about having come from a musical family. I think I also read that your grandfather was a minister.
Yeah.
Is that right? And your dad directed the church choir, so there's a strong church connection there for you. Did any of those folks ever feel that somehow jazz was a little too secular, that, maybe that wasn't the best thing for you to be involved in?
Well, my grandfather, I realize now, was a very progressive Baptist minister who very early on said, it's better to have all these young folks doing this stuff in the back of the church than out in some smoking nightclub or somewhere else where we can't keep an eye on them. And so he would allow me and friends of mine to come to the back of church and play and kind of do what we did. Some of the church members didn't think that was proper. They did think that that was music, the devil's music, and it should be played somewhere else. And he said, he made the point to them. He said, look, I mean, you've got kids here who are into something which is certainly not detrimental. I mean, they're doing what they do, and they seem to be enjoying it, and we can keep an eye on them. So it's not, I'd rather have them here than somewhere else. And it was many years before I realized how progressive thinking, what a progressive thinker he was. But that church alliance made an impact on me that has lasted until this day. Some of my recent compositions have been, they're jazz compositions, but they are reflected. Some of my religious attitudes. The next record that I have coming out on the TaylorMade label is called You Tempt Me. The basic material in the album is a suite, which was inspired by the 98th Psalm. And in one sense, says, make a joyful noise to the Lord, make a loud noise, and so forth. And although these are jazz pieces, what you have is rejoice, celebrate, walking in the light. You have things which are really reflecting, from my perspective, a religious point of view.
Hmm. When you were learning to play, did you have teachers per se, or were you more on your own, listening to other pianists, listening to what they do, trying to play what they could? Listening to records, sort of going by the ear.
Both. When I told my father I wanted to learn to play the piano, he sent me to a traditional teacher, a lady named Elmira Streets, who was a local piano teacher who gave me my first piano lessons. She was very disappointed because my brother, who's 4 or 5 years younger than I, did much better in the piano lesson. The only time I would kind of get down to work was when we were going to give a little recital or something, and I figured I was going to show off so then I'd learn my piece. But she was very disappointed. She said, he's got some talent, but he won't work at it. And the reason I didn't work at it was because it didn't seem to be getting me as close to Uncle Bob as I wanted to get. I wanted to play jazz and playing Bach and some of the rudimentary exercises didn't, at that point, seem to me to be the way to go about it. So I was listening to records, and I was trying to learn things on my own. And I had a very good ear, and she learned very early that she couldn't play my lesson for me, because if she played it, I'd hear it, and I'd play what she played rather than look at the music and try to learn it from the music. And so it was a combination of the two in terms of the learning process. But when I really got serious about the music, I realized that to have a good teacher, who I ultimately have, a man named Henry Grant, who understood where I was trying to go, and he made the connection for me. He was a high school band master who was also a fine pianist and a confidant of Duke Ellington and a remarkable musician in his own right. Said, look, Taylor, if you really are interested in those chords that Duke uses and everything, why don't you look over here? Now, here's some Debussy and some Ravel. It takes a fair amount of facility to play this stuff, so you've got to practice and you've got to work on that. But if you listen to the harmonies and you look at the harmonies there, it's pretty interesting stuff. He's using those 13th chords, 9th chords that you like so much. And I began to dive into that, and it really I could see how he used them in his own composition and writing Henry Grant and arranging, and it really made the connection. So I said, well, in order to get what I want, I got to study. I really have to work. So I really began to work seriously at it from the academic point of view.
You know, I reminded of an interview that I once saw with Wynton Marsalis, who was talking about Louis Armstrong, and he said he was talking about the fact that some people talked about Armstrong and used language like he was an intuitive genius, and Wynton says his comment was that's sort of like another way of saying he didn't know what he was doing, and I wonder if you have seen. You think maybe that there have been attempts, have been people who had tried to marginalize jazz in a way by you know sort of making backhanded compliments like that somehow implies that it's not a rigorous art form or it doesn't require a lot of thinking somehow, you know, that it was, I mean, but saying something like that really does make it sound like, you know, well, it's really not very hard work. And I wonder if you think that kind of thing has happened with jazz.
Very much so. It's still happening. In the early days, the first people to write about jazz, the first man to write about write a jazz history was a man named Robert Goffin, who was a Belgian. The next people were French, who thought enough of jazz to write about it as a serious kind of music. But they were fans. And they were looking at the musicians as noble savages and people who came into the music with this tremendous intuitive approach to the music and natural talent and all that stuff. And they really resented. I remember meeting Hugh Panassier many years later, and he criticized me. He came to Harlem, and I had met him in France, but he came to Harlem, and he was criticizing me because in those days I was playing bebop, and he said, "How could you leave the natural music of the Louis Armstrongs and the Sidney Bechets, the real jazz, and go into this noise?" And he's quite adamant about it because he didn't understand it, and he felt that what younger musicians at that point were doing were diluting this tremendous intuitive kind of music that he had grown up with. And he wasn't willing for people to take another step. And this is true of many people who have written about the music and many around today who don't understand the process of improvisation, don't understand the relationship between musicians of many cultures who come together now and contribute to the music in a very special way. Some people have backed up, some people who were African Americans have backed up and said that there are people who are not African Americans who can't play jazz. Sure, there are a lot of people who can't play jazz. I mean, so there are a lot of different aspects of the music that I think transcend its origins, and I'm excited about the fact that people like Wynton Marsalis and other musicians of his generation are not only fantastically well-trained, but articulate and really serving as beacons for people in their generations to move into another direction instead of just settling for some of the noise and some of the things which are on a lower aesthetic scale of any kind. And there's jazz, there's other kinds of music that fits that category.
Do you think that some at some points in the history of jazz that it also was maybe undervalued or devalued because it was produced by African Americans?
Unquestionably. This is a racist country for a variety of reasons. It's built into our legal system. It's built into our social fabric. I grew up in the South. I was born in North Carolina, grew up in Washington, D.C., and I've seen things change radically in my lifetime. Ramsey Lewis and I just played for the inauguration of the governor of Virginia about a week or so ago. If anyone had told me when I was a student at Virginia State University that that would ever happen, I would have thought he was crazy. I mean, a black man as a governor of Virginia? I mean, this is the capital of the Old Dominion. I mean, this is, you know, one of the most racist places, in my opinion, in those days, that one can go to. That's changed a great deal, obviously.
Okay, well, let's talk with some more people. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Hello. My name is Bill, and I'm a native of Richmond, Virginia, and I was just very pleased to hear Billy Taylor's comments about the changes in Virginia. And I also wanted to ask a question following the lines of how we get a continuation of the kind of development of interest in music, but initiated even younger, and I'd like to hear his comments about things that are going on or could be encouraged even in the earlier grades of elementary school. In many instances, minority and disadvantaged youngsters are increasingly less able to participate. I'd just like to hear his comments on that.
I would like some ongoing program of making instruments available to young people, such as they were available when I was a student many years ago, so that a young student can get his or her hands on a saxophone or a violin or some instrument and see, well, do I like this? Well, maybe not this one. Maybe I could play the clarinet or well, maybe the trumpet. I don't know. But you get a family can't afford to buy all of those instruments so that someone can say, yes, I do or don't like it. Yet if those instruments are made available through a church or through a school or through a community center, then it's possible for those youngsters to be exposed to the joy of being able to perform or at least begin to experiment with the instruments. Some of the electronic instruments are beginning to come into the schools, and piano labs and instruments that like that are being synthesizers. Excuse me, are being made available to some of the more affluent schools, but I would like to see some of the schools, some of the companies, make those instruments available to the less affluent schools. We have a program in New York called Jazzmobile. We use the improvisatory aspects of jazz to involve young people in four disciplines, in music, in the spoken word, in visual arts, and in dance movement. We find that when they can improvise, when they can be taken from the place where they are and given some instruction by a professional as to how they might personally employ some of those techniques, then it helps in all of their work. It helps their reading. It helps them focus on a lot of other things that they had trouble with before.
Who are some of the pianists that that influenced you most?
Oh, my goodness. When I was just starting out, my uncle gave me my first Fats Waller record. And Waller, for all of his comedy and all of the funny things he did, was a remarkable pianist. I mean, I learned later, I didn't know at the time, but I learned later that he played Bach and Mozart and actually gave a concert at Carnegie Hall in the 30s playing European classical music. He was a remarkable player, but the thing that attracted me was the verve and the energy that he played jazz with. I mean, he had a solid touch and just marvelous technical facility to play exciting jazz piano of that period. In listening to him for a while, then I began to listen to Teddy Wilson and to Nat Cole and to Art Tatum, who kept me busy for the rest of my life trying to emulate some of the kinds of directions that he started off in.
Yeah. You mentioned Fats Waller. Wasn't it too that he, you know, some people were kind of critical of his playing because they thought he maybe shouldn't be doing so much sort of novelty stuff, and that somehow they thought he ought to be doing more serious kind of music?
Yeah, many people did, but they didn't realize that he came up in an era that Louis Armstrong came up in, where the way that a black entertainer made it was by that kind of entertainment quality, by captivating an audience and being funny and doing whatever they felt would hold that audience. And that was a totally different audience than the audience that I play for. I'm standing on those people's shoulders. I don't have to do a lot of things because they did those things.
Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody else. We'll go to line number two.
I had a question. He was talking about the Americanness of jazz, and I was very interested in that. But I'm also interested in the roots of jazz, because I keep hearing so many people talk about their origins in the black church and all that, and I'm wondering if anyone has done a study on the African roots or the black roots, or has that been so Americanized now that you can no longer recognize those kinds of origins the way you can, say, in blues music or other African-American music forms?
The in the book that we were referring to a little earlier, I alluded to that, and I did quite a bit to indicate that jazz came directly from its African background. The fact that it has become international is a matter of evolution rather than having anything to do with where it originated from. African Americans, well, Africans were the people who were brought here and were not allowed to bring anything or not allowed to use any of the cultural supports that were a part of their daily lives in Africa. They were separated to an extent that quite often they didn't even speak the same language. So the one thing that tied them together was their relation to music and the arts, the various arts. If you go to New Orleans, you see some visual aspects of African Africanisms, if you will, in the manner in which those New Orleans kind of steel, iron works that you see in all of the buildings and so forth. That's very African. But as far as the music was concerned, many people have said that it was the coming together of African and European ideas that made jazz. That's not true. If that were true, then you would have had jazz in Africa, because Africa was colonized long before they brought slaves to this country.
Right.
And
right.
You didn't have jazz there. Mm-hmm. It was really the need for some cultural supports that made blues, jazz, spirituals, other kinds of music that came out of the black experience come into being. That led to the truth in this kind of music was so appealing that people like Bix Beiderbecke and Benny Goodman and many others were attracted to it and added a great deal to the music in its formative stages. And so it is not an exclusive, I mean, to say that it was originated by black people and by African Americans doesn't mean that it excluded people from other cultures. It just means that it came from a particular group.
That is jazz pianist and educator Billy Taylor. He was guest on Focus 580 in January of 1990. Billy Taylor died in December of 2010. He was 89. This year, our program turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we dug into our tape collection looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. And these are programs that were not part of our web archive when we started out this project earlier in the year. We hope soon they will be. In most cases, these are also shows that have not been heard since we first broadcast them. So that's why we called it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage near the top. You'll find a place to leave a comment. You may also write to us at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
To protect the life of a dog who is being abused, the hero of Scott Spencer's novel, Man in the Woods, gets into a fight and accidentally kills the man abusing the dog. In shock, he thinks,
"How can this be happening?" And he wishes, suddenly, fervently, that there was a God.
We'll hear from Scott Spencer on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In part two of today's Deep Archive show, we have a conversation with another musician, William Warfield. For many years, he was a much-loved member of the music faculty at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Over his long career, he performed all over the world. He had long association with composer Aaron Copland, recording his old American songs. In 1984, Warfield won a Grammy Award for his narration of Copland's Lincoln portrait. Warfield also recorded excerpts of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess with soprano Leontine Price. And many people will associate him with one song in particular, and that is Old Man River. He sang it in the 1951 film version of the musical Showboat. William Warfield was guest on our show, Focus 580, in October of 1990, and I asked him when he had started to think about singing as a career.
Oh, yes, I've always sort of had that feeling, but it didn't start from singing. Music started as a pianist. I started learning piano when I was a young kid, and around 16 years old when I was in high school, I started singing and then won a scholarship and when I was 18 to the Eastman School of Music in Rochester. But all of that time, although I loved singing and wanted to sing, my aim was to be a teacher because I didn't have too much faith in, so why should I be singled out to have a big career or anything like that? That was people like Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson. And I wanted to make sure I didn't put my eggs in the performing basket and then end up, you know, a pauper. So my big aim or my big drive was to get a degree to teach. And then, of course, it was interrupted by the Army and then back to school. And then I got into a thing called Call Me Mister in 1946, which toured the country. As a matter of fact, the summer of 47, I was playing the Blackstone Theater in a thing called Call Me Mister. And that went on the road for a year. And then when I got back in New York after that, that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to stick around and see what can happen if I do pursue a career of singing, mm-hmm. rather than going back and getting higher degrees to teach.
Did you believe that you would be successful? Did you have doubts, or were you pretty sure?
Well, I didn't. It wasn't a matter of believing I'd be successful or even having doubts that I wouldn't. It was a matter of being completely open to it. I was always said, well, okay, fine. I'm going to try this. If it doesn't work out, I'm not going to stay here and suffer. I'm going to go back and finish the degrees and go teach. That was always in the back of my mind to do. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't... I had enough encouragement to believe that I had a good chance to do it, or I wouldn't have stayed in the first place. When I was on tour Call Me Mister during that year, I remember I went and had a talk with then who was one of the big critic, Claudia Cassidy, at the Tribune. She had reviewed the play, Call Me Mister, and gave me a nice line, and I had an interview to ask her some advice, and I told her what I was interested in doing, getting into the field of concert and oratorio and things like that. And she encouraged me greatly, and people always encouraged me. Marian Anderson encouraged me. Paul Robeson encouraged me. So it was not that I went into it with doubts particularly, but I also was a very practical person and sort of realized, well, you know, I know there are a lot of people who are just as good as me out there that are not making it either, so I wasn't going to suffer particularly. If it came to the point that nothing worked, I was not going to just stay around indefinitely. Mm. But fortunately, that was a three-year period in there that everything was progressing towards what finally turned out to be a major career.
I am interested in the business of teaching singers, and what seems to me to be interesting about it is that the instrument, you can't see the instrument. Mm-hmm. Other sorts of instruments, you can at least say you're teaching someone violin. Mm-hmm. You can say to them, no, you can actually put your fingers on their fingers, and you can say, now this is the way to hold it. This is the way to hold your bow. This is the way your fingers should come down on the string. With singers, all that stuff is going on inside, and I wonder how you do that. I mean, how you teach
singers. Well, of course, basically by the sensation that the person feels. Now, you have to relate the sensation that they're doing or hearing to what is the correct way of producing sound, and that can get into very, very complicated discussions of resonance and all kinds of things. But basically, I could say that the voice is a built-in wind instrument. You have breath going over the vocal cords that sets them into motion. And that is basically, if you would say it's a clarinet, that would be the bowl of the instrument. Then all of the resonators in the head, sinus, these are the resonators which give the focus to the tone. And once that is all in place, and with the support of the breath, that's why the singer has to be particularly trained in breath and support of breath, because that determines how well he is going to sing or how easily he's going to sing. But in addition to the focus and the bowl of the pipe, the singer has a different thing, an added thing that instrumentalists don't, and that is words. And they are projected through the tip of the tongue and the lips. And all of that has to be taught a singer to do correctly. I could just quickly say, for instance, if I tried, you can't separate the focus or the reed in the voice because it's there. The clarinetist can take his reed off and blow, and you hear hoo, hoo sound. But then if he blows his reed, it's a little nasal thing. With the human voice, it's a matter of having a combination of those two. Then you teach them how to do that and how to fill up these cavities. And then once that's all in place, then how to focus it outward through the lips and the tongue in form of words. That in a capsule is something that I've said in a few minutes that takes a long time to perfect, and we call that the vocal technique.
When singers come to you, say singers that are at the point of being university students and probably have been singing for some time, do you find that there are still that you have a lot of work to do, or by that point is what you're doing, in a sense, fine-tuning?
By that point, when they're in their 20s, the basic technique should be on its way. And then what you do then is guide that voice through the additional growth that comes as a result of age and practice and whatnot. The unfortunate thing is sometimes you do get a person who, for some reason or other, has had maybe not as good a training or good a basic training in his technique as possible, and he's developed habits that then you have to go about to correct. And that is very difficult because once a person has deliberately worked on doing something a certain way, if that way is wrong, to have to change it around and break them down to take another approach is much more difficult than a person that comes up that just opens their mouth naturally and is saying, and you tell them what they're doing and relate it to what they're feeling while they're doing it, and actually get them to learn the theory, learn what's happening with the vocal cords, learn what's happening technically, I mean really what happens with them, so that they have an awareness of it. But you can't take a singer and say, okay, the palate has to be up, this has to be down, and that has to be down. Now open your mouth and sing. Once they've done that, they're locked in and they wouldn't be able to make one sound. So it's in almost retrospectively, they sing and you say, now you feel what's happening there. You hear what's happening there. And then there you relate that to what your ears are telling you is the correct way, and watching them to know that they are doing it correctly. And then eventually they have to really, well, right from the beginning, they have to get into a practice room and work that out. Come back to you each week, and that's how they progress. Sometimes my greatest criticism of students is they'll come in and I will work with them in a voice class, and then they'll go out and they come back next week and they haven't gone into a practice room to try to put that into practice. And unless they do that, they'll never learn a technique. It's a matter of just like now it is the same process as the instrumentalist. You can't tell an instrumentalist, here, put your fingers here and do this now. Then he has to go in a practice room and work for hours to make that finger do, or that hand do that. And it's the same way with voice, but because voice is a natural instrument, sometimes students think, oh, good, that's fine, then they'll come back the next week and they haven't worked on their technique at all. Mm-hmm. And it requires really working on it. As I said to somebody, it's a matter of going in there and finding your soul salvation. Or as the old folks used to say back, every tub has to sit on its own bottom. I can lead you to it, I can show you, but you've got to work it out in that practice room yourself.
So there is something that I think is true of your singing that I don't hear in a lot of other singers. And I wouldn't claim to be any sort of expert any more than just a casual listener. I think that many singers sing at you and some sing to you. And I think that you're a singer that sings to people and not at them. And I wonder, is that something that, do you think that's something that you're born with? Is that something that you can teach?
That you're talking about is up to a certain point, can be pointed out, and a person can learn it. But basically, once you're past technique and learning how to produce sound and how to correctly sing and how to do a phrase, the language being correct, the intent being correct, and all of that, the individual person has to bring something to that is of themselves, their thing, and that you can't teach. No. I see students sometimes, they come to me and boom, there they are in the in my studio, and there's a presence, there's a projection. Sometimes you have to really harness that, because I've had occasions where students came in and they had everything but the technique. So you have to put a harness on them and pull them back and teach them how to use their voice so that then they can then turn them loose and let them go for broke. But that thing I think you're trying to describe is walking out on a stage, looking at an audience, making a connection, and following through mind to mind. That is something that you can't teach a student to do.
How did you happen to get the part for Showboat in the film?
Basically, my manager in New York tried the year before the Showboat came, was actually going in production. He had heard about it, and he arranged for me to go down to MGM Studios in New York at that time, and I actually made a recording and sang for him in the studios, and we never heard anything about it at all anymore. And then the following spring, after my debut, I was in Australia, and my manager was with me, and we were looking in a paper, and there was a Hedda Hopper, who was one of the big Hollywood, Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons were the big Hollywood reporters then, was syndicated there. And in her column, she had mentioned that Arthur Freed had still not found a person that he wanted to use to do Joe in Showboat. Now, my manager was getting ready to come back to New York at that time, and he said, well, I'll tell you, he says, I'm going to go and I'm going to get together all kinds of photos, composites of you, dressed, casual, and I'm going to send them to Dori Sherry, whom he knew out in Hollywood, who was running MGM at the time. And he says, and you go and get the Australian Broadcasting Commission. That was what I was touring for, the Australian Broadcasting Commission. And ask them to let you record Old Man River. So I did, and I went in a studio, sat down at the piano, and they recorded my playing Old Man River and singing it. And they sent that recording to Dori Sherry in New York, along with letters about me and that I was having a very successful concert tour in Australia. And Arthur Freed came into, who was the producer, came into the Doris Sherry's office that morning, and he showed him all of these pictures and played the record that I had made myself. And they were struck by it and wired my manager, called my manager and said, we want him, and signed a contract. And I got a cablegram saying that I was signed to do Joe and Showboat. Hmm.
And so this was your first movie?
Yeah.
Was this the
first and only movie. I went out to do another movie the next year, but the movie never really. It was going to be a musical version of Huckleberry Finn with Danny Kaye and Gene Kelly, and I was going to play Jim. Dean Stockwell was going to play Huck, and the music was written by Lerner Lowe, beautiful score. What happened was Gene was finishing off, I think it was Invitation to the Dance at that time, and he was delayed starting production because he had to finish his own. In the meanwhile, Danny Kaye was supposed to go, I think, to Selznick or somebody by December to do, I think, Hans Christian Andersen. And the time got shorter and shorter and shorter. And finally, when MGM wasn't able to strike a deal to have Danny Kaye longer, or, you know, the Selznick could push back their production, they had to cancel the whole thing. And they paid off Danny Kaye and me, and of course Gene was their property, so he was on salary anyhow. And I'd gone out there and I'd spent about a couple of months. I'd learned a tap dance routine that I was supposed to be doing with Gene Kelly and Danny Kaye, and was having a wonderful time. I was just chagrined that the picture didn't take place.
Would you have liked to make some more movies?
Oh, yes. What happened during the period of time between that and there was nothing, the vehicle never came up that we wanted to go after. I was not interested, for instance, I was doing a lot of singing in my field and all of that, and I was not interested in just going to Hollywood and getting a part as an actor or something like that. So it would have had to have been something that came up that had to do with music and singing, or a role, and a Huck with Jem would have been exactly that kind of a thing if we'd done Huck Finn. And, of course, Joe in Showboat was that thing that really started, got me the movie in the first place. But if you look through, you don't find too many things in that period that followed that was something that was right up my alley, if you want to say. So we never did another movie.
Mm-hmm. There must be film versions of Porky and Bess.
Oh, yes, there was the big film version that Preminger put out with Dorothy Dandridge and Sidney Poitier and all of that. But all of the voices, well, except for Pearl Bailey, who was Mariah, and Sammy Davis Jr., who was Sporting Life, their voices were used. But the Porgy, the Bess, and the Serena, all of those were dubbed voices.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't done with it. It was done from a theatrical Preminger did it from the standpoint of who was famous black artists at the time. Sidney Poitier and Dorothy Dandridge were. So he wasn't interested in just getting. Leontine and I had just done it before they went into the production. But that was already, he'd already negotiated for things, and he would not have been interested because we were not famous actors. Mm-hmm. We were in music, but what we were approached to do some dubbing, but it didn't work out because the kind of thing they wanted to pay we didn't feel was, you know, right.
When after you did Showboat, you didn't see any of the rushes, you didn't see the dailies, all that kind of stuff. No rough cut. The first time that you saw yourself on the screen was
later on when they had a sneak preview in New York at the Lowe's Theater on 86th Street. I had not seen anything. Well, there was no reason that I would have seen it because what happened was all of the rushes and things were done daily, and then the picture didn't go into editing until long after I left because they had to. I finished, say, for instance, before December, and they worked into the first of the year with close-up shots and all of that kind of thing, and it wasn't ready for issuing until I think it was spring it came out. I'm not quite sure, 51. So unless I had just particularly requested to go in and watch daily the rushes, which I couldn't do because I was busy doing the thing itself. There was no reason why I would have seen it until it was finished and the preview came. And so that's how that happened.
And what was it like when you were sitting there in this darkened theater and suddenly saw yourself there?
It was totally mind-boggling, actually. There I was on the screen. I had a problem at first really relating myself to what I was looking at on the screen. Number one, because I didn't, you know, your self-image, what you think of and what you see in a mirror, a lot of times are two different things. Plus the fact that it was one of these big, wide screens, and there I was, as I use the expression, big and bold as brass, and there was this guy standing up there singing "Old Man River," you know, and I knew I related to it in the sense that, you know, I knew it was me, but I had to think, oh, that's what I look like. Oh, that's what I sound like. It was all of that was going on in my mind at the time. Aha, that's what's happening. That's how I project, you know, seeing myself in the eyes of somebody that was sitting next to me rather than myself as I know myself.
Did you think, boy, I look pretty good, or did you think, is that really the way I look, or did you not even think about
it? I didn't even think about it. I was just awed by the whole process, and by the time it finished and people started applauding and things, I mean, I was really very emotionally taken up in it because I was just sort of wide open, you know, sort of, my God, is that what that image is making people do? And that was really a moving time for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever listen to when you're at home, sit down and you put on one of your recordings?
Never. As a matter of fact, most of the time that I ever listen to recordings of mine is when I'm a captive audience, meaning
like this,
like this, or when kids come over sometime. For instance, I have a tape, a video cassette of a Showboat, which my nephew gave me for Christmas several years ago. And every once in a while, some of my youngsters here that I teach said, "Can we play it?" And I say, "Yeah, go in the back and play it on the TV," because, I mean, I just don't even want to look at it, you know. And then they would giggle, and I'd hear myself singing back there, and I'd say, "Oh, my goodness." Because that was in 1950, and this is 1990. And to see what I sounded like and what I did with it now, it's grown a lot from the standpoint of inner things.
Is there anything that, a particular piece of music that you would have liked to perform that somehow you never got round to? Any particular roles maybe you might have liked to
see? Well, in opera, you see, when I came along studying, opera was not open to blacks. And by the time it did open to blacks, I was pretty well established in my career doing what I was doing, not concert, oratory, and whatnot. And I did opera. Opera was a periphery thing in the sense that I did concert versions of it. As a matter of fact, I even did a scene with Leontine way back in the days on the Kate Smith show of the Amnasro Aida duet. And if I had been in opera, the one role that I would have liked to have done was Boris Godunov.
Well, isn't that one of the great bass roles?
And my voice takes to the Russian language where I do the songs and dances of Death and Mussorgsky, and that's just a delight for me singing in Russian.
That's William Warfield on Focus in October 1990. From 1975 until 1994, he was on the music faculty of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. William Warfield died in 2002.